What does the new Future of Nursing report from the National Academies of Sciences, Engineering, and Medicine tell us about the state of the American nursing profession and the delivery of equitable health care in this country? Let's talk all about it with Dr. Greer Glaser, Professor and Dean Emeritus of the University of Cincinnati School of Nursing, right here on episode 348 of The Nurse Keith Show. Hey there, this is Nurse Keith. This podcast is all about you, your personal and professional development, your career, and the healthcare system and nursing profession as a whole. And I'm here to share education, ideas, diatribes, and informative interviews like this one today with some of the most inspiring people from the worlds of nursing, healthcare, medicine, entrepreneurship, and beyond. I love having you along for the ride, and I thank you from the bottom of my nurse podcaster's heart for being part of the growing Nurse Keith Nation. And here's a very, very, very special request. If you find value in this podcast, please consider becoming a patron at patreon.com/nursekeith. That's patreon.com. Creating more than 350 episodes incurs many costs over the years. And I'm asking 100 regular listeners to pledge $2 a month for a year. That's less than the cost of buying me a cup of coffee every month. And you can rest assured the show contains no additional caffeine, sugar, or empty calories, just more and more audio awesomeness for you. So please sign up to support the show, just like Edward from the Bay Area, Marie from Tennessee, and Jocelyn from New York. You can always pledge more and get some great stuff from me as a thank you, but $2 a month would be amazing. So head over to patreon.com/nursekeith. And if you are in need, or a colleague or friend or family member, or the family dog is in need of holistic career coaching, please send them over to nursekeith.com to schedule a complimentary chat. And if you mention Greer Glaser or the Future of Nursing Report, you can get 15% off your first coaching package. The show notes for this episode, which are very important to all nurses in the United States and beyond, will be at nursekeith.com/episode and the number 348. And Dr. Greer Glaser, I'm very, very honored to have you here to talk about this new Future of Nursing 2020 to 2030 report, which just came out. And we'll get to your stellar bio in by the by, but can you briefly explain the history of the Future of Nursing report? Where does it come from? And how many times has this report surfaced once again?
That's a good question, Keith. The first report on the future of nursing was 2010, 2020. And there were recommendations and major messages in that report. And a lot was accomplished, but there still was more that needed to be accomplished. And so the second report is the 2020, 2030 report on the future of nursing. And it is from the National Academy of Sciences. And what's so awesome about this report is that there are 15 members of the committee who were appointed. And of those 15 members, the majority are not nurses. So this is a group of people who are experts in healthcare, finance, medicine, economics, all kinds of things, really great expert on racism and social determinants of health. Anyways, lots of experts. And they've given us recommendations for the health of the nation and the contribution that nursing is going to make toward that. And so the report is about strengthening the nursing workforce so we can achieve health equity and healthcare equity for all.
I see. And when the first one came out 10, well, almost 11 years ago now, was it expected that this was going to be a process that would be renewed every decade and we would keep moving forward in this particular manner?
I wasn't part of that original report, so I can't say for sure. But I would say that there were definitely stretch goals. The goal is an ideal that we have health equity and healthcare equity for all. Mm-hmm. And so I would think that we would expect that it would take more than 10 years, but I would expect, again, with the key recommendations that are in this report, that it will take longer than 10 years to get to where we want to get for that too. So I would expect probably to have another report in 30-40. But I do want to say this. There are over 4 million nurses in the United States. Mm-hmm. I believe that the majority of nurses have no idea about the first or the second report. So one thing I really want, and why I wanted to do this with you, Keith, I want every person who is listening to share this report with every nurse they know, every person they know, every friend, every acquaintance, every relative, so that the message gets to the larger public. Because what this is all about really is the health of our public. Mm-hmm. It's everybody's well-being.
That's true. And speaking of not being involved in the first one, you're involved in the second one, Future of Nursing Report 2020-2030. What was your role, or what has been your role vis-a-vis this report?
It was an incredible opportunity and process. And I'm so honored that I was able to be on this committee, because there are fantastic nurses all over the United States and globally. So many people could have had the seat that I had. Mm-hmm. So what was the process was, these reports, because they're from the National Academy of Science, have to be evidence-based. So we read thousands, each member of articles in all of the topics that you'll read about in the report, so that anything that we came up with and said had to be supported by evidence. So it was reading all of this. Then it was coming up with what the content should be. Various members of the committee had more responsibilities in various chapters. But we were all responsible for every word that's in there. And so we came up with all of the messages and recommendations. We had writing pieces in various chapters, and we signed off on every word in that report in the final version. So it was very labor intensive, and really a wonderful opportunity to really learn about many things that might not be my expertise.
That sounds like a very powerful and humbling experience. And the report is 503 pages. I have it open right here in a PDF, and it is available in paperback as well. And in the paperback, there's 502 pages. So you might want to get the paperback. It's one page less. If you're going to share it with friends and family and people who aren't healthcare providers, there are kind of abridged versions and kind of summations that you can share as links, which could be really helpful, because you don't want to overwhelm a non-healthcare person or even some healthcare people with a tome of 500 pages, because it's overwhelming. I haven't read the whole thing yet, but I plan to this winter. But I did what a lot of people do with this sort of thing. I read all the introductory information and the forewords and all that sort of thing. I read, you know, the first few chapters, and then I read the end. So I know how it ends, you know, and it's kind of like watching the end of a movie or reading the end of a novel before you get there. But what I gleaned from this, one, is that there's 9 major silos of recommendations, and they have particular themes. And one of the themes running throughout this, you've already touched on, which is health equity, healthcare equity, and social determinants of health. And nurses care about this sort of stuff. And we're the boots on the ground. I often say we're the mitochondria of the healthcare system, or you could say we're the connective tissue, we're the lifeblood. So from your perspective, you've been a nurse for quite some time, right?
Oh, over 40 years.
Over 40 years. And right now you're professor and dean emeritus of the University of Cincinnati College of Nursing. And you've taught, you've done research, you've been in clinical practice, you've done community service, you've done policy work and advocacy. So you've worked across the spectrum of what is possible to do as a nurse. You have over 100 publications, 220 presentations. You've written a book called Nursing Leadership from the Outside In, which I've heard of, and I would like to, I'd like to get my hands on. And you're the co-founder and legislative editor of the online journal of Issues in Nursing. So, and you're a Fulbright scholar. So just saying, I mean, you've been around and your credibility speaks for itself. And the fact that you were invited to this panel to be part of this committee to make this report a reality is quite a statement about who you are. And I know you care a lot about structural racism, dismantling it, and building a workforce that reflects the diversity of the country that we see around us. So what are your takeaways from the report in terms of what could actually happen to make that a reality, to continue to dismantle structural racism and create more equity? What's on your bucket list and what's in the report?
Wow, there is a lot in the report about this, which is very exciting to me because I know in my own experience, talking with lots of people across the country, there are still people that do not believe there is such a thing.
That's very true and sad. Yes.
You know, so they don't. So like really the first agenda item is discussing what structural racism is.
Okay.
Acknowledging its existence and then figuring out ways of dismantling it both within our own personal space and our workplaces.
Okay. And if we want to dismantle it in, let's just take healthcare environments, because that's really where it's at for us at this moment. So if we want to dismantle structural racism, you're saying it can start with personal processes, right? We can all be involved in those. And many of us have been looking more deeply at this since George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And those are mentioned in the report, I noticed. So the contemporary issues of structural racism are very real in the report. So within a healthcare environment, what are actions that, let's say, a nurse can take personally to start to alter the system in which he or she interacts because they work there?
Mm-hmm. Well, this starts really with how I view each nurse.
Okay.
And I view each nurse as a leader and a nurse taking on leadership to do what should be done. So when you're asking about what an individual nurse can do about structural racism is embedded in the policies and practices of our institution. So the healthcare setting where the nurse happens to be employed, it could be a hospital, it could be home care, it could be a college or school of nursing, you know, wherever that is. What are the policies and the practices that are embedded in the places that we're working? So it would be starting with an examination of all of that. And so that's why I always have thought leadership is so important. So an individual, any individual can start that.
Yes.
Of course, having somebody who's got a position by virtue of their position as a leader, they certainly can start that. So, you know, as an example, at the College of Nursing that I was, University of Cincinnati, we predominantly enrolled students. We did process of taking students in was largely determined by students' grades and test scores.
Right.
Okay, that's a process that really disadvantages groups that are in schools that aren't equally equipped with resources. schools that don't have courses that students could take if they were at another school. So they're getting fewer points because of that, you know, all kinds of things like that. So we ended up going to a holistic, changing the whole way we admit students by using a holistic admissions process. So the same thing, I think, and this is not in the report, but this is something that I've been thinking a lot about. Sure. How do we hire nurses in healthcare settings? And if you're on a floor where everyone looks the same, why aren't we having a diverse workforce on that floor? How are we hiring people? And are we just hiring people based on hiring people just like us? Or is there a different process that could be used in hiring people so we change the composition of our workforce?
Good point. And within the report and the recommendations, because these are recommendations that institutions can adopt or not, right? And we hope that the more nurses read this, the more people involved read this report, they'll get fired up and pressure the organizations where they're involved to take on some of these recommendations and make them a reality, right? So what does the report recommend in terms of structural racism? What actions can institutions take on a larger scale, even bigger than what we were just talking about?
Yeah, I mean, you know, so they do speak to this. And, you know, honestly, it starts with having certain ground rules. You've got to have a safe space. You've got to have expectations for civil discourse. Mm-hmm. You've got to reward people who are leaning in to these conversations. We have to take individual blame out of conversations about racism and bias. I think that is a huge one, because oftentimes an individual nurse believes that they are being blamed for institutional racism or racism. It's not an individual. We're talking about structural and, yes, and organizational.
Yes.
And so we've got to be precise and consistent with language, not boring people with all kinds of numbers of what's the problem, but actually telling stories. You know, if all of us, no matter where we're working, if we ask the question to people, have they experienced structural racism, a group that's from a group that's been marginalized, you're going to hear a lot of stories. I guarantee you there's stories in every single place. So it starts with that, because everything is local, isn't it? So what's happening in my institution isn't happening in yours and some of it. So what's happening where you are? So finding out what is going on there. And really explaining race and racism is part of a larger framework of understanding marginal social identities. So we have to have these fearless, frank, free discussions about all of these things. And we need to talk about solutions. And there was an article written by Peek and Chin. And if you look at the name, I'd say go look at the people who are on the committee and you can read things they've written. One of the people that was on the committee is Marshall Chin. He's written an article, with a colleague, they've written an article on academic medicine, and it's all about teaching about race and racism. And so that would be something I would recommend people take a look at.
Great. There's so many important pieces here to cover. And switching gears a little bit here, let's talk a little bit about public health and community health and how, you know, I've always seen, as a career coach, that's what I do. I work with nurses all over the country. And there's a lot of focus on acute care. And I think, isn't it 50 to 60% of nurses work in acute care? And that's very, very important. ER, ICU, trauma, those things are the real sexy things, right? That's what everybody seems to want to do. However, I've always been in community health, public health, home health, et cetera. Federally qualified community health centers, all that sort of thing. I've never even worked in acute care in 25 years. So what does the report say about the need to promote public health and community health as viable career options for nurses? And how can we build our public health capacity using nurses, because we're so important to the public health infrastructure, especially in the context of a pandemic?
It's such an important question. And I learned a lot in reading a lot about it. And so here's like, I'm going to give you a few interesting facts that are just scary.
Yes.
It's scary for the public. Only 1.5% of nurses in the United States are public health nurses. And only 2.3% of nurses in the United States are school nurses. Okay. So as you were alluding to, we don't have a lot of community health nurses and we don't have a lot of school nurses. So you mentioned I was an educator and I was a dean. I get to thinking, like, why is that? Why would so few people go into these things? And as you said, there are other things that are sexy, other things that seem, oh, it's so much more important. How much do students actually get clinical experience in community health and school health?
Tiny.
Not much. And at the very most, in the vast majority of our nursing schools and colleges, they all get a community health, public health course, one course. But the problem is this. Most people that are getting acute care now, it's like intensive care. They're getting acute care and they are back in the home and community very quickly needing nursing care. So we need to have many, many, many more people going into public health and school nursing, and we need to teach more of it in the schools. So it starts with what are students getting in their educational background? So a lot of the recommendations, if you look at the education chapter, which I had a lot of influence over as the person who had, I think, the most experience in nursing education over time on the committee. A lot of people did, but I think I did. There's a call to have this content throughout the curriculum and in every clinical course. There's no reason why pediatric nursing should be all in an acute care setting. Why aren't we in the schools? Why aren't we in the homes? Why aren't we in the daycare centers, the places where children are? Med-surg. Yeah, why aren't we out of the hospital, you know, back in the community and all? So it really is a matter of we need more of them. Now, why don't people go into it? Because they didn't get it in the educational setting. But also, the pay isn't as good.
Just going to go there.
Oh, yeah, I know. And it's in the report. If you look, we had a health economist, Peter Bearhouse, was on our committee. He did a really beautiful chapter on payment. And you need to read it if this is something you care about.
I've read some of it, yes.
Public health nurses and school nurses get paid very poorly. And so
exactly.
we need to elevate the pay of the people. The only problem is this. I mean, it's complex. That's like, I think one of the things, you know, I'm an optimistic person. Mm-hmm. I believe there's so much we can do and I believe we will do it.
Yes.
On the other hand, it's so complex that nothing is an easy solution and just one thing that has to be done. Okay. So mm-hmm. like in answer to that, so school nurses are paid by a variety of ways. They could be paid by the school system. They could be paid by a health department. They could be mm-hmm. paid for an acute care site. They're paid by different places. There's no one way that they get paid. And in fact, this is a shocking statistic. Think about this. We need more school nurses. Only 40% of schools employed a full-time school nurse in 2017. And this is even worse. 25%, one quarter of schools in the United States have no school nurse at all. Nobody ever.
Many parents are, yes, and many parents are aware of this.
Yeah.
And we can't say that, you know, over the years we can go down many rabbit holes here, but over the years I've heard many nurses cast aspersions on those who work as school nurses and community nurses because they feel it's not real nursing. And one of the issues I see, and this is a deep rabbit hole, but I just want to mention it, is that if we want schools to teach to, let's say, structural racism, community health, public health, health equity, et cetera, I believe, and hopefully this is happening, the NCLEX needs to continue to evolve to reflect those, because schools teach to the test, because a lot of their funding and how they attract students is how many of their students pass the NCLEX, of course. So we need the NCLEX to reflect the reality that we're shooting for, so that students will have to study such things and the schools will need to address them. So that's a whole nother issue, isn't it?
Can I've got to say something. No, I got to, like, I agree with you 100%. And in the report, there are recommendations that the things that we're saying are critical to the healthcare equity and health equity have to be on NCLEX. The tests have to change. So that's for sure. And then, you know, the schools have to change what they do. But, you know, you're voicing something that I have heard too, that I believe is so untrue about school nurses and what they do. Okay, what do school nurses do? They treat and help students manage their chronic health conditions and disabilities, because they come to school and they're there to do that. They address injuries and urgent care needs. So they got to be prepared for whatever comes in the school, including, which is a whole nother whole area, school violence and all that. They need to provide preventive and screening services, health education, immunizations, psychosocial support, conduct behavioral assessments, and collaborate with everyone else around to facilitate holistic care that each kid needs. They want to help kids stay healthy. And if you look at what we know now, and COVID really illustrated this, we've got huge issues with mental health in the United States, both with adults and kids. So they've done studies, and a quarter of all school-aged children and adolescents struggle with mental health issues. And 30% of student health visits to the school nurse are for mental health concerns. Now, I wouldn't call that easy. I wouldn't call that not real nursing. Yes. And these are our kids and our future. So if we're not going to deal with this, nurses in schools are at the forefront of frontline healthcare. They're often the bridge between the healthcare system and educational settings. And they oftentimes, especially in under-resourced areas, which could be rural or urban, they're oftentimes the only healthcare professional that a student has regular access to. So the point of the report is, get people the care they deserve where they are. And it has to be paid for. So payment is a very, very big issue.
Those are incredibly powerful points. And when we come back from a break, I want to talk a little bit more about this school nursing issue and community and public health, because it's so close to my heart based on the work I've done and what I believe, and obviously what you believe, and talk a lot more about what's in this report, because it is such an important moment for us, especially vis-a-vis the pandemic and what we've been going through these last 20 months, 21 months. So we'll be right back for the second half of episode 348 of The Nurse Keith Show. So now we're going to take a pause for the cause for just a moment. Please consider becoming a patron of The Nurse Keith Show, just like other awesome listeners who value the show so much that they want to give just a little bit each month to support the work we're doing here. When you pledge, you not only get the satisfaction of helping produce and support The Nurse Keith Show, you also get some pretty cool premiums and gifts from yours truly. Just head over to patreon.com/nursekeith to read all about it. That's patreon.com/nursekeith. And if you know someone who could benefit from career coaching with me, please consider referring them. And if they become a paying client, you'll receive credit for an hour of coaching with me, and there's no expiration date on that credit, so you can keep it in your back pocket until you need it most. And remember that you can refer as many people as you like and continue to earn those coaching credits. What an incredible deal. And please head over to nursekeith.com and sign up for my newsletter, which comes out regularly and brings you supportive messages, updates from my blog and my podcast, resources, and all sorts of other stuff. Remember, nursekeith.com, sign up for that newsletter, and you'll also get a free download from me as my gift to you. Anyway, those are my sincere asks today. So now, let's dig back into today's topic without further ado. And welcome back to the second half of the episode. Remember, the show notes are going to be at nursekeith.com/episode and the number 348. We're here again with friend of the pod, Dr. Greer Glaser. And prior to the break, Greer, we were talking about, oh my gosh, structural racism, school nursing, social determinants of health, and this Future of Nursing Report 2020-2030, which is such an important moment for us. And right before the break, we were talking about school nursing. And I just want to say, just recently, I did the keynote for the annual conference of the Illinois Association of School Nurses. And that is a very dynamic, large, and very thoughtful, conscientious, forward-thinking organization. And I know Gloria Barrera and several other people from that organization. And school nurses are so, so important. And if you think about it, like you said, children are the future, right? In some school right now, at this very moment, it could be a kindergartner or a third grader. That child is the future president of the United States. It's either the future speaker of the house or the CEO of a hospital system. And that might sound, you know, like I'm talking about the far-fetched future, but what happens to that child now determines a lot for that child as we go forward. And isn't that a lot what public health is about? And aren't school nurses and community health nurses really at the forefront of public health in the United States?
I mean, yes, they are. The only problem is, which is documented in the report, it is so fragmented. The public health care system is so fragmented, and people aren't able to interface with others. And the funding for all of it is so minuscule. I think the funding for public health in the United States is about 3% of everything. So we're like totally underfunded with all of this. But the stars of the show and the future really are the people providing care, the nurses providing care in the communities and schools. And, you know, I just want to get back to what we were talking about before, which yes. is what's real nursing and what's, you know, so the most complex, I think, and I think a lot of people on the committee also believe that the care of people in their homes and communities and providing outstanding public health is the most complex of anything. Mm-hmm. And so if we're looking at social determinants, we're looking at things like housing, violence, food, air quality, all these things, that takes us into another realm, really. And I do think this is a major growth from the first report, that nurses' role in social determinants of health in terms of assessing social determinants of health of the people we're caring for and intervening and helping to address whatever these needs are, it's part of nurses' role. And so this is hard. This isn't easy, and it is going to involve being involved with multi-sector partnerships, people we haven't usually been working with.
That's right. And you mentioned that housing is important. There's so many other issues. There's climate change, which affects health, right? And gun violence, et cetera. And we have organizations like the Alliance of Nurses for Healthy Environments. That's really an important organization. They're at Envirn, ENVIRN.org. They're an important organization. Those are nurses who are getting involved at that very high and deep level in terms of what can nurses really do and what do our voices mean in terms of, let's say, environment and climate change. And the Illinois Association of School Nurses, what can they do in terms of having a strong voice? And we have we have a complex country, right? We have political polarization. We have the pandemic having been politicized. You talked about public health being underfunded. I actually had the founder and CEO of the Public Health Foundation on the show not that many months ago. And we talked about the underfunding of public health. So what does the report say about making public health front and center? Because we often realize how important public health is when disaster strikes. But public health goes on in the background invisibly at every moment of every day. So what does the report say about making it a central aspect of what we think of as the health of the nation?
That is one of the major points of the report. It's all about we must invest in public health, disaster preparedness, school nursing, so that we are able to have healthcare equity and healthcare and health equity. Without that, we aren't going to be able to make much progress, but it's so complicated and there's so much that needs to be done. That's why, you know, again, what's a real nurse? What's a nurse's role? What should people do? You'll see it in the report, and I feel very strongly about this. We need to ramp up our efforts related to policy development, analysis, evaluation, and advocacy. You know, your role in policy development is as important as your role as direct patient care. Direct patient care, very, very important. But if something's not getting paid for, it's not happening. And we know that. So, you know, I mean, a very concrete example, advocating for addressing social determinants of health. If the assessment of social determinants of health is not paid for a nurse to do that, how much is it really going to happen? If the intervention related to addressing what we learn about somebody's social determinants of health is not paid for, how much are we going to really be able to intervene? So this role that we've got in public policy development is huge.
Right. And if we make this important, and then there's pressure from above and below, from grassroots nurses and on the at the other end, if we make this very important, then let's just say electronic medical records will need to address these issues so that a nurse actually addresses it. Because if the nurse, if it's not in the rubric of the EMR, it might not get addressed. Or if it gets addressed, it'll be offhand, offline, the nurse having a conversation, but it doesn't make it into the documentation. So then it's not seen as important. And we all know from the first day of nursing school, if it's not written down, it never happened. Right? So nurses do so much that doesn't get captured. And isn't a lot of the work we do around SDOH, social determinants of health, not captured anywhere?
Yeah, you're 100% correct. But I want to tell you another reaction I'm having to what you just said.
Sure, tell me.
I actually did research in the area of interpersonal violence. All right. And so then in my career, we went from never asking anybody anything about it to now it's part of a record. We ask everybody, do you feel safe in the home? You know, the questions that have to be asked. Okay. But again, in my personal experience, I have found a lot of times that it's kind of a cursory question. Do you feel safe in the home? Or, you know, and it's just, you know, checking off something on. That is not what we are calling for here in this report. What we are saying in the report is that people's social determinants of health are critical in their ability to achieve health and wellness. And it's got to be an integral part of what we do and not just checking off something on a list that we've got to do, but it's got to be something that we believe is as important as asking somebody about what have they eaten in the last 24 hours. You know, it's as important as somebody's food intake.
Right.
So Anyways, I do want to say one more thing that I'm thinking about here, and it is back to the policy. I mean, I'm recommending people really take parts of this report and read them over time, because it is too much to read in any one setting. But there's such good information. I'm going to read to you from page 167 of the book. Like, I didn't know about, okay, I've got a PhD in nursing. I've taught policy. I didn't know this. About 45 million children are enrolled in Medicaid. Since December 2014, federal law has allowed school nurses to bill Medicaid for services to beneficiaries. But only a handful of states have taken advantage of this opportunity. Currently, only 7 states allow students to receive free care under Medicaid. So to me, again, it's allowed federally. It's at the state level now. All the nurses in these states, other than the 7, should be out there advocating to be able to get free care for children that are enrolled in Medicaid in those states. That would be a nursing role, something that is critically important for achieving health equity.
Absolutely. And I'm looking at page 167 now, and 7 states allow students to receive free care under Medicaid. I'd like to know what those 7 states are, how they got to where they are, and why the other states have not addressed this. And advocacy, policy, these are also important. And I'm on the board of the New Mexico Nurses Association. It's a very activist organization with lots and lots of advocacy. And they have done an incredible job for years. And let's talk a little bit about nurse practitioners and advanced practice registered nurses.
Okay, I'm excited.
So granting full practice authority to nurse practitioners, why should states do that? How many states have done it? And what would be the holistic impact on social determinants of health if we had 50 states where nurse practitioners could practice with full practice authority?
Well, one thing you didn't mention in your intro of me, I am a women's health nurse practitioner too. Mm-hmm. So I've functioned in that role. And, all the schools I've been at have had nurse practitioner programs. And it's such an interesting question, because I was very active in the Ohio Nurses Association years ago that actually gave the ability of nurse practitioners to practice in Ohio, because you have to have title protection first before you can get your scope of practice. You've got to be named as a provider. All right. But anyways, right now, 23 states, the District of Columbia and Guam, have full practice. And because of the COVID epidemic, a number of states relaxed their scope of practice so that nurses, advanced practice nurses, could have full practice authority. But not really surprising to me, we're seeing a lot of those states now say, oh, we want to go back to the way it was. We don't want advanced practice nurses to have full authority to practice. So first important point, the majority of states in the United States do not have full practice for their advanced practice nurses. So people need to know about what's available in their state, what's going on, and what's happened historically, because all the states have had efforts to try to remove barriers to this. But why is it so important? Why should they do it, you asked?
Yes.
It's because everybody doesn't have access to healthcare, number one. So it's to improve access to care. Mm-hmm. People need to have a provider to provide the care, and there aren't enough physicians, for sure not enough primary care physicians to provide primary care out there, both rural and urban.
Because so they don't get paid well, so they want to go into other specialties where they can pay their liability insurance and pay back the cost of medical school. So why should they go into primary care, right?
Okay, the report doesn't say that, but that's a very interesting point.
Yeah.
But so first is, we want to provide everybody access, and that's healthcare equity. That's being having equity for healthcare. We don't have that because people don't have equal access to healthcare. Mm-mm. And one of the reasons why is because we don't allow full scope of practice for advanced practice nurses. So even though there are advanced practice nurses in a state, they can't provide the primary healthcare. Okay, that's number one. Number two, and very important, there are years, over 40 years of studies that document the quality of care of nurse practitioners, advanced practice nurses, is equal, if not better, to the care provided by the physician. So the quality of care, so it's the people, it's to enable advanced practice nurses to provide high quality care. People don't have the ability, not only they don't have care, but now we want them to be able to get high quality care. And that means they should be able to get care from advanced practice nurses.
Yes.
The last thing that sort of gets to what you said, Keith, is when you don't allow this competition and don't allow the advanced practice nurses to practice to the full scope of their licenses and practices, oftentimes the healthcare costs go up because there's no competition, right? So you got a few providers, there's only ones you got are there, and there's no way to have competition for price. So we do know that oftentimes there may be higher costs related to that. So I find particularly upsetting, really, is the fact that the states that relaxed these requirements during COVID because they needed to get care to people now say, oh, let's go back to the way it was. And the usual argument of why they haven't advanced the scope of practice is that the opponents say that it's a quality of care issue. But we know now from years of work and what's happened with COVID, the quality of care is not impacted in a negative way. Mm-hmm. So there's really no reason for this. And this is a personal thing I want to say that I just think people need to know this. There are groups, and one of them in organized medicine, the American Medical Association, which most physicians don't belong to, just like most nurses don't belong to the American Nurses Association, which is a shame. Yes, you should, yes. But all right. But most physicians don't belong to the American Medical Association either. But the AMA has had a concerted campaign, millions of dollars, to block granting nurse practitioners and advanced practice nurses expanded scope of practice in the states they don't have it. And go ahead and just Google that and go look for the campaign. There's emails out there that were written to every physician that's part of the American Medical Association claiming victory for stopping expanding the scope. And so, you know, one of the things I would like each of you who are, if you're an advanced practice nurse listening to this, you work with a physician. I'm sure you do. Most people don't work totally alone. They work with groups or whatever. I think it all gets down to relationships and the people that you're working with. Go talk with them about this and let them be the ones to also advocate for expanding scope of practice. So a major recommendation in the future nursing report is that nurses should be allowed to practice to the full scope of their licenses and education. That's a huge one. So yes. What that means, and I think we need to do, we need to partner with consumer groups, with the people we care for, with physicians that are working with us, with social work, with everyone to make that happen. It's going to take all of us to make that happen across the United States. But what's the benefit? The benefit of it is we'll achieve health equity and healthcare equity. That's what our goal is.
Well said. That is so important. Now, you talked about the pandemic and how licensing restrictions and practice authority restrictions were loosened because we needed people to be able to practice and provide care. Let's talk a little bit, because the report does mention this, and I read that last night, about licensing compacts, right? We have a compact for nurses. I think it's 20 six states or is it 27 now? I can't remember. I'm in a compact state of New Mexico. So that licensing compact is an amazing thing to be able to cross state lines easily, right? So during the pandemic, we've needed nurses to do telehealth in other states from the state where they're sitting at their computer at home. We've needed nurses to cross state lines during surges. And we also need nurse practitioners to be able to do the same. So what does the report say about licensing compacts, which I think are so incredibly important right now?
Well, Keith, I've got to tell you, I'm not positive what the report says about that. I would believe, so you could go back and look, but I would believe that there is interest in making sure that nurses can practice wherever based on their expertise. And so having a compact for everyone that allows them to provide that through telehealth is something that I believe the report would be supportive. Ohio was one of the states that wasn't part of a compact, and we just had legislation that just approved it, and it's going to not take effect for another, I think, year or something. But I do believe that the future of nursing will have lots of telehealth and lots of movement and people from one state to the next providing care. And there are going to be more disasters. There are going to be more crises with pandemics. Yes. And, you know, and more. So we know that's what's going to happen. So it would make sense for us to figure out how we're able to deliver care the most efficient and effective way, which is going to involve lots of telehealth and the ability of people to cross state lines.
Yes. And I just put compact into the search bar in the PDF, and on pages 363 to 364, we have recommendation number 4, which means enabling nurses to practice to the full extent of their education and training, removing barriers. And the actions recommended are to permanently adopt any changes to these aspects that were adopted during COVID-19.
Right.
So to keep them open, to look at nationwide adoption of the Nurse Licensure Compact. And it says, the Healthcare Regulatory Collaborative should work to advance interstate compacts and the adoption of model legislation to improve access, standardize care quality, and build interprofessional collaboration and interstate cooperation. And then it goes into paying for nursing care. So it's right there in the report in, let me see, recommendation number 4 of 9. So,
well, thanks for going back. I wasn't positive about that, but I do want to say again, this has been a theme of our conversation. So yes. You start enabling nurses to provide telehealth. Mm-hmm. Are they paid for it? A lot of places, there's no pay. They're not written in. Again, in some of the states, it's nurses are not written into the ability to get paid for telehealth. So again, whatever we're saying needs to happen, we always have to keep the hat on and ask, are we going to get paid for it? Is the pay the right pay? You know what? Yeah. So.
Well said. Yeah, exactly. And I could talk to you for hours, and I think we're going to have to revisit the report because it's 500 pages and we can only cover so much in an hour. Let's go to what is another very important topic for both you and myself, which is nurse well-being. So what does the report say, and how do you personally and professionally feel about what we can do in terms of promoting nurse well-being, which we have seen really underscored over the last 20 months or so, haven't we? Mm-hmm.
So this is a chapter in the book, and I feel very strongly about this one. I always have. When we're taking care of people, we're part of a relationship. How I am as a person is going to impact what I'm able to do, you know, with whoever it is and our community that caring for. So my own personal health makes a huge difference. My own health and wellness makes a huge difference. So what am I doing about it? And what are the organizations that I'm working in doing about it? And so I was really happy to see a recommendation in this report that was said by 2021. We're almost there, guys. Hmm. We're at the end of October. We don't have that many months. Recommending that all of the employers have wellness programs that they're starting to adopt and implement. So I'll say that it's shocking in the report on page 307, there's a snapshot of the physical health of the American nurse. It's shocking how bad it is. So just like read a few of these things here. The average body mass index for nurses is 27.94, which falls into the overweight category. Only 11% of nurses report a daily intake of at least 2 servings of fruit and 2.5 of vegetables. Fewer than half of nurses report not engaging in regular muscle strengthening exercises. Just over a third say they have adequate access to employer-based exercise facility and programs. Only 44% rate their health is good. 25% is very good and 5 is excellent, which means the rest, almost a third of the nurses say that it isn't very good at all.
Right.
So we've got people and we know that we've got burnout. We've got mental health issues that have been exacerbated, PTSD with dealing with the COVID epidemic. So if your health as a nurse isn't very good, what do you have to give to the people that you're caring for? So it is not, so it's a personal issue for you deciding what are you going to do about your own health and wellness. And it also then is the organization. I read to you, only a third have some kind of programming. We need programming where we're working that deals with the health and wellness. And there's some really, really good examples of different organizations, both Ohio State and University of Virginia, that have programs for their very holistic programs for the people working there. Another part of this, this is going to be like putting things together from other parts of the report. In order to address individual health and well-being, people, it's a habit. A lot of these things are habits. You've got to change habits. So if your sleep is bad and you're not eating right and you've got no physical activity and your intake isn't good, you can't change everything at once. So it's all about behavior change, changing one behavior at a time and making it a habit. A lot of this is about when we're looking at wellness and health is about your own resilience. How resilient are you? What else are you doing? So for instance, personally, I got very involved in mindfulness-based stress reduction. And there's a lot written on this chapter about mindfulness interventions.
That's great. MBSR.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So I just became a certified level 1 teacher out of Brown.
Congratulations.
I believe so much in it. But part of the message that I wanted to give here too is this. A lot of what we do as nurses is we help people be as healthy as they can. Okay. So my question is this. If I'm not doing anything myself and I'm very unhealthy, why should I listen to you if I'm the person telling you? It just doesn't make sense. I think we all need to be role models. If you're a nurse, I think you signed on to be a role model for health and wellness. So
yes.
That means then what are you doing about all these things yourself? And what are you doing about them and with people? And what are you doing about them with the places we're working. So there's stuff in the education chapter on behavior change, motivational interviewing, mindfulness programming and all that, because it's critical for our ability to be able to do the jobs we're doing. And I just have to say, I'm in awe of every practicing nurse, wherever you are. What we do, what you do is hard work, no matter where you are, and it takes resiliency. We're exposed to so much trauma. We've got a lot that we do to ourselves because of the situations that we're put in. So we have to address it ourselves, and the people that employ us, they've got to figure out the right programming to be able to help us be the healthiest that we can.
Thank you, Greer. Wow, this has been so wonderful. And I wish we could dig even more into this, and this will have to happen again. Maybe we can have other folks who were involved in the committee back on the show later this year or next year and dig even deeper into what the recommendations are and how they can actually be brought into reality. So Dr. Greer Glaser, thank you so much, Professor and Dean Emeritus of the University of Cincinnati College of Nursing. And thanks for talking about this Future of Nursing Report 2020-2030, which is so important. And I'm just so impressed by your level of accomplishment. You've been a Fulbright Scholar. You've been a Robert Wood Johnson Executive Nurse Fellow. You've been chair of the ANA Political Action Committee. So many things that you've done, and you really set a high bar and an example of what a nurse can accomplish in the course of his or her career. So thanks for your 40 plus years of service, and thanks for being involved in this report and being on the show. It's really been an honor and privilege.
I just want to say to everybody else out there, the things that I have done, anyone of you could do. Mm-hmm. It just takes doing it. It really is. So I'm going to challenge you all. I'm going to challenge you all. Just be the best you can be and mm-hmm. do what you can do. But anyone can do it if they just put their heart and their mind to it.
Thank you so much for that message.
Thank you.
Well, there you have it. Thanks for listening to this awesome episode of the Nurse Keith Show. And remember, go to nursekeith.com/episode348 to read the report, to download it, and to read about Dr. Greer Glaser and her incredible career. And if you need personalized holistic career coaching, remember, go to nursekeith.com, send me a message. And if you mention Dr. Glaser or the Future of Nursing Report, I'll give you 15% off your first coaching package. And if you could become a patron of the Nurse Keith Show, I'd appreciate it at patreon.com/nursekeith. The Nurse Keith Show is a proud member of the Health Podcast Network at healthpodcastnetwork.com. We are adroitly produced by Rob Johnston of 520R Podcasting. Thank you, Rob. And Mark Cappy-Speeson is our stalwart social media ringmaster. They both keep the wheels turning and the ship going. Mixing metaphors here, in the right direction. Be well, dig deep, seek joy, keep in touch. This is Nurse Keith saying adios till next time from beautiful, windy, and cold Santa Fe, New Mexico, and the inimitable Dr. Greer Glaser bidding you arrivederci from
Rock and Roll Hall of Fame City, Cleveland, Ohio.
Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you, Dr. Glaser, and we will catch everybody on the flip side.